When she was a child, she kept on her bedroom mantelpiece a little oblong blue-grey leaden plate saying, "Danger of Death." It portrayed a rudimentary skull shape and a symbolic zigzag bolt of electricity, and displayed these three plain words of warning. She found it in the gutter on the corner by the sweet shop in her hometown of Leeds, and she was very fond of it. Her mother tolerated it, and it survived many a half-hearted spring clean and attempted clearance. 8 years later, she added to it another sign, which she had found lying under the lichen-encrusted stone wall of a French cemetery in the Auvergne, declaring "Danger de mort." She thought of building up a collection of similar items, but she didn't. She didn't persist. And when her parents sold the house and moved to a cottage in Wharfdale, her childhood bedroom was dismantled, and the danger signs, along with other more easily valued treasures, disappeared during the removal. Her love of trespass, however, did persist. She was attracted to keep-out notices and enjoyed breaching boundaries and exploring forbidden ground. She dated this tendency to the early thrill of breaking into the abandoned garden of a large derelict house which she and her two friends passed every day on their way home from school. The front gate to the drive was chained and padlocked, but it was easy to squeeze through the fence and set up a little camp in the overgrown shrubbery. They called their camp the Wilderness, a word that delighted them. They would crouch there and eat the lurid little shop tartlets of scarlet jam and glaringly white artificial piped cream that they had bought with the money they had saved from their bus fares. If they opted to walk the mile and a half home, they could afford a tartlet each. Their mothers would have disapproved both of the trespass and of the tartlets, but the sense of the illicit added to the pleasure.
Hello, and welcome to the final podcast in a series of specially commissioned recordings brought to you by Thresholds, the online international short story forum hosted by the University of Chichester, who joined forces last year with Small Wonder, the Short Story Festival, to record four special discussions that we've been calling Short Story Masterclass. My name's Steve Wasserman, and the writer you're just about to hear me talking to really needs little by way of introduction. It's Margaret Drabble.
So, two metaphors kept on returning to me when reading your collected stories, particularly with regard to your more recent writing. And the first is the idea of the short story as a puzzle, a kind of enigma, but maybe also a sort of jigsaw puzzling entertainment. And the other is the idea of the short story as a kind of an excursion, a sort of a ramble. And I was wondering if either of those appeal to you, both as a reader and as a writer of the short story.
Well, the puzzle aspect of the story is, of course, there, but usually in better made stories than mine are, in that the story asks a question and then provides sometimes a trick answer, the last piece that makes sense of it all. Though it is true that I'm extremely fond of jigsaw puzzles, so there may well be some jigsaw puzzle aspect to my stories. And I suppose it is that the last piece, which is the last sentence, clicks and suddenly you get a new shape. And of course that is one of the satisfactions of writing a short story, that when you find out what the last sentence is, and you don't always know, it does make everything fit together. But the rambling one is more my kind of story, in that I walk a lot, I enjoy walking, and a lot of these short stories that I've written have been connected with walks, with excursions, with travel. I think that short stories are very good for using landscapes or adventures in places that one wouldn't want necessarily to expand to fit a whole book, that you glimpse something mysterious quite fleetingly sometimes, which makes a perfect story.
And apart from your own work, where you do that quite a bit, who are you thinking about when you're talking about that kind of story, the story as the excursion. I mean, someone like Paul Bowles comes to mind for me, who does a lot of that.
Yes, indeed. Very atmospheric stories with a sense of wonder, adventure, and not quite sure where you're going to end up. And yes, absolutely. I mean, Catherine Mansfield has quite a lot of stories that are just, in a way, place stories, that people are in a place and the place is the story. An excursion, an adventure, a bit of seashore. I think the idea of wandering freely and finding yourself somewhere unexpected is quite important.
I like that word, wandering freely, because as we move through the story, it seems to become more and more hybrid as a piece of prose. So you get, at times it almost feels like you're reading maybe even a newspaper article. You get the stuff on the listed buildings and Lionel Penrose. It almost felt like at times like one of Will Self's psychogeography pieces. I suppose the question is, are there limits to this hybridity? Is that how you see the form? Do you see the form, unlike maybe a novel, or maybe like a novel, of something that can just, where you have the freedom to explore in that way?
You certainly have the freedom to explore, and I'm interested that you mention Will Self. Ian Sinclair is also another great explorer. And, I mean, he just goes to places in order to turn them into stories, and we all do a bit of that. But I was also interested in your reference to journalism, because, I mean, this particular story, which is now called Trespassing, Trespassing had a curious sort of origins, in that originally I had proposed to the Guardian newspaper, which originally published it, that I would like to write a piece about nuclear power stations and EDF. And I didn't think of writing it as a story at all. I wanted to write a factual piece. And the piece I wanted to write would be an anxiety piece about how foolish it was for Britain to allow people to buy up all its public utilities, a piece which I now see has been written in the London Review of Books after I wrote this, by James Meek, the piece I would have written if I'd gone on with it as that subject. He's done it better than I could have done. But the idea, I realised, I could turn into fiction. And what I then did was go on the walk. But I, by that time, had already got the material about Hinkley Point in my head, the material about the nuclear power station, and I had done quite a bit of wandering through other places for a novel I was writing. So some of the wanderings were making their way into another, much longer work of fiction, but I saw how I could put them together with a completely different meaning, completely different purpose in this story, which is in fact a protest about selling up the British coastline. It's a polemic, but it's quite a wandering polemic. I have to be honest, what really attracted me to doing it was the thought of going for this physical walk, and I so enjoyed the walk, and I chose a good day, and I laid it all in front of me, but the walk itself was very, very memorable to me.
And that enjoyment of the walk, which then transmits itself to the story, seems also key to those other stories in the volume. I mean, Stepping Westward is the obvious one.
Yes. That
use this structure of an excursion to create a story around them.
Well, I am very much a Wordsworthian, and Wordsworth was always going on walks. I mean, the Prelude is full of him describing going on a walk to have an idea, and I do a lot of that myself. So in a story like Stepping Westward, I would be describing various journeys that have come together in one version of the story, which is a sort of search. It's a sort of mixture of a walk, a pilgrimage, a quest. And to me as a writer, it allows me to put into the story the things I've seen, the things I've enjoyed, the writers I've read who have written about the place, in particular with the West Country, Wordsworth and Coleridge, the Quantocks they were very much associated with. And so it's a way, to me, of bringing various parts of my life together. I think a lot when I'm walking about the narrative of a valley or a river, which I suppose is a bit sort of psychogeography. I feel as though I've walked along this river many times, I've climbed up these steep paths many times, and there's a narrative in my walking, there's a narrative in my aging as I walk, in my remembering the walks I've been with friends, with my children when they were little, and my children now they're older. So there are lots of stories woven in.
And what I love, as I say, what I love about these particular stories is the freedom that they afford you, clearly, as a writer, and to some extent the reader. I suppose the thing I'm interested in, though, is how do you maintain a narrative tension in this kind of story, which is sort of got it all in it? I mean, how do you do that as a writer?
Well, I'm not sure that I know how to do it. I don't know if I can explain how to do it. But there is a mixture of wanting to get there and of knowing that that each walk has its limit and its journey. And there is also the knowledge that something will happen on the way. I mean, somebody said to me the other day about walking around his house in Wales. He said, I go for these walks and you know there will always be an event. And by that he means perhaps just a bird he hasn't seen in a place he hasn't seen it. And yet, before you set off, you don't know what the event will be. The pleasure of writing the story is putting in the unexpected events. I mean, in the story, Trespassing, the real gift to me was at the end of my walk. I was quite nervous about trespassing, and there was a lot of sort of keep-out signalling going on. And I met this, I think he was a Filipino man, standing in the middle of nowhere.
Oh, so this is very much based on fact? Because this is exactly what happens in the story.
Absolutely. Right. I went on the walk and he was there.
Right.
And of course I didn't interpret him in that way when I saw him. I was puzzled by him, why he was there. But the actual detail of the story, I mean, was what I encountered on that one day.
I mean, it's a really pivotal moment, isn't it? And I'm fascinated to hear that is how you experienced it, because in a way, of course, this is your most recent story, but it links up so exquisitely to your first story, because you have at the end that sort of epiphany, don't you, of that character who realizes that the sense of otherness that he has felt is an illusion, and that seems like a kind of a liberation, an unshackling. I'm talking about Hassan's Tower here, and yet in this story, in Trespassing, it seems the opposite somehow. That there is actually a sense of, I don't know, there is a sense of anxiety.
There is, and that is because the world has changed.
Right.
I am older, the world is older, and the world is a less peaceful place than it was in the 1960s when I wrote Hassan's Tower.
But it also seems to touch on a kind of existential lostness, a sort of an existential loneliness, perhaps, that I get about the character.
Yes, she is feeling old and displaced, and she's very cross that her pension is not what it was and that her electricity bills are going up all the time, which is absolutely a normal feeling for an ageing person in Britain today. I mean, I'm sure that strikes a lot of chords with a lot of people, yeah. That we feel, that, I think they're called the squeezed middle classes now, that she got her pension but it wasn't worth what she thought it was, and her life seems slightly under threat. And he signifies the threat, but he's not the person who's threatening her. He's just part of a system that's not comprehensible to her.
It sounds like what you're saying, to some extent, of what lifts this story from journalism, from the original piece you thought of, the original article, into the realm of the short story, into the realm of fiction, is a very kind of tight framing. And I think you get that framing in those first two paragraphs, where you have that that keynote of anxiety, and then you have a sort of a variation. You do a little variation on that anxiety, because that anxiety then moves into a kind of excitement, doesn't it, in terms of trespassing and in terms of even a sort of sexual excitement. Is that something you're consciously aware of doing when you sit down to write the story? You think, right, okay, I need something to draw the reader in here. I need to sort of hit a kind of an anxious note to sort of unsettle them a bit, so they then want to move with me into this landscape.
When you say to draw the reader in, that's not quite how it works for me. It's to draw myself in.
Uh-huh.
It's me as the adventurer. Uh-huh. I need to unsettle myself and to remember why it is that I'm drawn to unsettling places, why it is that the trespassing. And then, of course, I exaggerate it, because I don't spend all my time trespassing, but she is more committed to the pursuit of trespassing than I have ever been. But I have been interested in it in my time. But the difference between writing it as journalism and as a polemic against Electricité de France and writing it as fiction is that in fiction you can embody things, you can put in landscape. I don't think an economist or a politician would be interested in my response to this landscape, to the fact that the trees looked as they did, that the birds looked as they did, that you have these silver leaves shaking and the little birds, which I found infinitely moving.
And but a beautifully poetic line there.
She clambered over the stile into the forbidden land, her land, and walked on into the undergrowth. There was a tangle of elder and bramble, and a little flurry of small birds took flight at her approach. They took flight from a slender tree with silver, shaking leaves, small birds moving like the flickering spirit of one small soul, silver leaves moving and lifting their light faces in the dying wind of autumn. Now, I remember what I felt when I wrote that. I felt, I have described that little silver shaking tree. I've also got into it the feeling that England had one soul, an undivided soul, a very patriotic thought. She says at the beginning of the story that she's not a little Englander, but she is profoundly moved by England. And I get that story into it, the soul of England. I get that feeling that she's put in there, the feeling that we were on one soul, one, but we're little birds all moving away from each other at the same time. And you can't put that in journalism. They don't like that kind of thing in journalism. And I don't think I would have written that had I not just reread Coleridge's poem, which is bizarrely enough describing this exact landscape that I was walking through. I mean, I know Nether Stowey, where he had his cottage, quite well, but from this walk I went on the coast path, which is in the story, you can actually see the trees of Nether Stowey, and he writes about them in the poem I found, and I suddenly felt that feeling of everything coming together, what I was seeing, what I'd read, what I felt about England, what the character feels about EDF. It all seemed to come together in this image, and that's very satisfactory when that happens.
Mm. And I suppose that another thing you can do, which you wouldn't be able to do, that sort of again brings it more into the realm of fiction, is those personal touches. The fact that you tell us that the young woman had recoiled from the word asylum, and then you tell us why she had recoiled.
Yes.
And you know why, whereas of course a journalist would see that, but wouldn't choose to ask.
Yes, yes. I mean, that again was based on a completely different excursion for a totally different purpose. And I think, no, I haven't put it in the novel I've been writing, because it didn't fit in the novel, but it fitted perfectly there. So what happens when you write a story is that little things cluster together from thoughts you've had here, thoughts you've had there. That asylum was in Essex, and it's quite a famous building. And I was just pleased to find it a home. It seemed to fit in extremely well, the sense of belonging and not belonging, which is what the story's about.
Mm. And that fitting in, when you were talking about it, I mean, there again I have the image of the jigsaw puzzle. Is that also the sense you get, where you can kind of go, right, ah, that piece that I've had hanging about, I found a home for it.
Absolutely right. I wouldn't have thought it in of it in those terms. I wouldn't have actually thought of it, but you're absolutely right. I thought, well, I can use that there and I couldn't use it in the other place. I remember Alan Sillitoe saying to me years ago when he gave me, I mean, he loved maps and he loved walking, and he said, and he gave me a book of bits of things that he'd cobbled together from other places, and he said, never waste anything, they'll all fit together in the end. And I just thought that was very interesting too. And it is satisfying when they find a home next to each other and it makes sense.
So would you say that in a way short stories, you could describe them as sort of artfully cobbled together? Are all fictions in a way kind of artfully cobbled together bits and pieces?
Well, it's very interesting. I'm sure that the true short story writer, and I don't consider myself to be a true short story writer, would hate the phrase artfully cobbled together. But I think that I, being at heart a novelist, do find that my stories cobble in or put together things that hadn't seemed to join together, but that have found a home at last.
Now, of course, one of the kind of Ten Commandments, I suppose, that is often given by those self-defined short story writers, I'm thinking particularly of Chekhov, is that old chestnut, in a way, don't tell me the moon is shining, show me the glint of light on broken glass. And what I actually quite love about certain parts of the story, particularly that paragraph you read at the beginning, is that you do... It seems that you do quite a fair amount of telling. I mean, you tell us what Elizabeth Clitheroe thought about this and that and the other.
She was infuriated by the way the website had invited her to play meter reading games as though she were a child, not a householder and a professor emeritus. And she was also illogically infuriated by the fact that the company demanding so much of her hard-earned money was French. The French seemed to be buying up the power stations of England as the Americans and Malaysians had bought up Britain's water supplies. Elizabeth Clitheroe did not think of herself as a little Englander. She thought of herself as a European. But there was nothing European about this disembodied, rapacious monster of a company. It had no loyalty to its English clients, no love of the land it built upon. It was the invader from across the Channel, a conquering Bonaparte from an empire without borders or defensible frontiers, French in name, but global in ambition.
I'm not really sure what my question is, but I suppose the question is, you know, where can one, or even should one tell, and where does one need to show?
I think about this quite a lot when I'm writing, and I think, well, I'm telling too much, I must go and have a look. And this is physically when you need to go and have a look and show. And this is when maybe you need to go outdoors and have a look at something rather than sitting at your laptop and writing. You need to go and get the light. And I remember, this wasn't in a short story, it was in a novel, but I remember being struck by some very powerful odour. And I thought, I never write enough about smell. And I went in and put in a sentence about her kissing her friend and the smell of face powder, which is quite distinctive. And I thought, sometimes you just get little reminders and triggers of how to show and not tell. But I do, you're absolutely right to point out that I do tell rather a lot. I mean, I tell what people are thinking. I describe analytically their thought processes. And I enjoy doing that. And I have to remind myself, which is why walking is good for me, that showing what it looks like is also very important, the physical
but
showing.
But I like the telling. I think it sets up an interesting, a sort of a dissonance in a way, because you've got the author telling us about Elizabeth Clitheroe. Mm-hmm. You've then got your sense of who this person is. And then you've got perhaps a third Elizabeth Clitheroe that neither the author nor you even know, that sort of belongs to her. And between those three,
yes,
the character emerges.
It's always amazing to me how a character emerges. And they kind of either think themselves, this is a thought piece, or they talk themselves alive. They say something and you think, good heavens. And then you go along behind what they're saying. But sometimes it's just a narrative voice. Now, Doris Lessing, who's a short stories I greatly admire, she does a lot of telling. I mean, she will even begin Once Upon a Time. and she'll begin with quite a strong sort of frame of telling 10 years ago. And then she will interject something very immediate, like the woman lying on the roof being stared at by the workman. But she also tells as well. I think the mixture of the two is probably what makes a story where you have a very strong physical image of what's happening in the story, but you're also told a bit what it's about and what it means to the person who's going through the experience.
I mean, there's something very, very enigmatic happening in the story between, you know, from all the childhood material then leading into her concerns and her, I suppose, sort of political passion, what is essentially a passion. That enigma and that sort of unresolvedness about the character and what her motivations are, is that something you've resolved for yourself, or does this character and how it all kind of knits together, is it still sort of mysterious and enigmatic for you?
I think it's quite enigmatic. I don't really know what happens to her. Right. I mean, I don't think she's very happy. Well, it's obvious she isn't very happy. But she's, yes. I think that it continues to be confusing for her. Like, she's still confused. She doesn't quite know what the person that she met signifies. She's alienated. And then she switches on her radio and she sings to herself, "I am a stranger in this land." And that, I did wonder about whether putting that ending on, I thought it might be a little too, the musical allusion might be too, when I say literary, too musical, too intellectual. But then I thought it fitted so perfectly, that extraordinary line, that I would leave it in there. So I did actually, I mean, you said about altering things, changing things. I took that line from the opera in and out several times. And in the end, I thought, in fact, I actually do remember now going to, I remember going to a music shop and asking what the line was in Italian, because I only had it in English, and I found it. And when I found it in Italian, I knew I should put it in, because it would just bring it all, her feelings together at the end. So, yes, she's confused, as I think probably I am still, about the future of EDF and all the things that we should be doing. I mean, since I wrote this story, things have changed about the power stations. They're not going to build it, I don't think. So it's, she could say her walk had brought the whole massive project to a halt. But really what has happened is that they have now realised the tremendous difficulties which the story explores.
Do you think maybe the short story as a form is more germane to this kind of unresolved confusion, and maybe that's partly what we like about them, because that is the tenor of our lives quite often, that they have this sort of, you know, whereas a novel is often more resolved, isn't
a
it?
A novel does try, yes. Well, novels now do end in an open-ended way far more than they used to do, and I do like a sort of open ending. I like a sort of metaphorical open ending. But the short story quite often, I mean, successfully gives you a feeling of ambiguity and lostness and uncertainty that if you were to explore in time, you'd have to do something else with. You'd have to develop it. And some of these feelings of angst, they come and they go, and the short story can describe the moments when they come. Though the short story can also describe moments of relief at the end when you think you've resolved your problem. I mean, sometimes you have a happier resolution.
Mm. Well, I think that's a good place to finish. Thank you so much for doing this for us. It's been a real pleasure.
Oh, well, it was very interesting. I hadn't looked at that story for a bit, so I was very pleased to see it again. Yeah, I was amused to see it again.
Great. Yeah. Thanks.
Oh, that's good.